I've had a lot of coffee, and this one stands out. It's called Larry's Coffee. It has this really cute vibe to it, first of all. I've been drinking it in the mornings, and it's noticeably smoother. My favorite blend is Bean Martin. It just tasted so good. I immediately went and got a second cup of coffee. I just love the rich, dark flavor. It's got a little cartoon character on the bag, and he is drinking coffee, and he also has a martini because it's probably an espresso martini because, you know, he's Bean Martin. They have light, medium, dark roast, espresso, decaf. Larry's Coffee is independent, family-owned and operated, roasted in Raleigh, North Carolina for over 30 years. You can try this wonderful coffee and support the BGS Podcast Network at larryscoffee.com/BGS. Listeners of the BGS Podcast Network get a free gift with purchase when they purchase through that show link. And again, that's larryscoffee.com/BGS.
I truly believe, like, if you can teach any skill to, like, an 8-year-old, you fully understand it. Mm-hmm. And so, like, teaching has been my cheat code of, like, even getting proficient at writing and producing. 8-year-olds are little impatient humans. You can't be like, oh, let me wait till I'm inspired. I need to think of an idea. It's literally like, all right, we're going to make a song. All right, what are we doing next? It's like, all right, okay, we're going to do this.
We often define artists by their output, their records, books, movies, and the times they're on stage.
But the art is made in the quiet, the struggle, and the mundane, the hours that no one sees. I'm Michaela Ann.
And I'm Aaron Trafer-Hayes. This is The Other 22 Hours, an exploration of the creative life, lived in the in-between.
Today's conversation is featuring James Garden. James is a Michigan musician and songwriter. His music blends styles of hip-hop, R&B, funk, and it's really infectiously danceable, joyous music. And he's been writing and releasing original music for many years and has had quite a lot of success in the sync world. His songs have appeared on TV shows like Bel Air, Queen Sugar, CW's All American, and global campaigns for brands like Saks Fifth Avenue, Tommy Hilfiger, Puma, Fabletics, Apple, and Square.
Yeah, this conversation is a continuation of our core theory and purpose of this show is to show that there's no one right way to build a career around your art, be that music or writing or whatever medium you choose. And so James is really one, we kind of go a little bit deeper on the nuts and bolts of the sync and licensing world, which if you listen before is a world that I am familiar with and have done work in. So for those of you who have sent in questions asking about that, this is the episode for you. We talk a lot about that, both on the creative side and on the business career trajectory side. And we also talk a lot about the importance of arts education, all three of us having a deep history in teaching music as well and battling the stigmas of that and the joys and difficulties in that, all around the narrative of there are so many paths to take. And the sooner that we can realize that as creators and entrepreneurs, the more opportunity lies in front of us. So with that, please enjoy our conversation with James Garden.
We always like to start off the conversations with just a how are you today? How are you really? And where are you physically and creatively?
Ah, that's good. I think I'm feeling good. It's funny. I had a meeting, a very long meeting. So it was like a lot to talk about, like just managing emotions of other people on the team. So that's always like a little heavy, but I think it was necessary. So it feels good that like things were said that needed to be said. Physically, I'm at the house.
Nice.
And creatively, as of late, I've felt very inspired, and I think I'm like finding ways to have fun again. So it feels like a good space.
What does that look like for you? Finding ways to have fun?
Like just doing silly stuff. Like if I want to just talk about nonsensical stuff or just like nerd out on the techniques that I want to do, whether that's in writing or production, that's been kind of fun. And just like exploring new ways to do stuff.
Totally. Yeah, I feel that. I'll do that less at the moment since we're dealing with two little kids, but like getting to come here in my studio and just be like, I'm just going to throw some paint at the canvas.
Yeah.
Like, try this. It's like, oh, this is fun. It's called playing music. Cool. Yeah, right.
Well, one, I want to come back to bookmark navigating like team calls and like the business aspect of your work that you mentioned. You do a lot of sync stuff, right? You get a lot of placements and TV shows and commercials. Are you writing for that, or is it that you're making your music and then it thankfully gets placed in these commercials and TV shows?
So I think for me, it's a happy medium. It's funny. I jokingly tell people that my sound is male affordable Lizzo. So it's like, it's empowering. It's always groovy and danceable. And so I think those aspects are things that like, I'll always drift towards those. That's what I like to make in general. And so I think the happy mistake is that that does work a lot for sync. And so I think at that point, the only thing I'm really like editing is like arrangements and making sure stuff's building. But outside of that, like content, I rarely write things that I wouldn't want to write when it comes to sync. Whether that be the right way to do it or not, I've seen some success with it. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, I do a bunch of sync too. And luckily, like the rep that I've been with for the last 6 years now, coming up on 6 years, that's what he always says too. Luckily, he supports that. He's like, write songs that you want to write.
Yeah.
You know, for those not in the sync world, there are verticals. I get lumped into like the Black Keys-y kind of stuff, or like the singer-songwritery, epic, dramatic, Grey's Anatomy
emotional
type stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, especially when it gets kind of like Black Keys-y, I've definitely gone and made stuff that's just straight jock rock that like I would never make for myself.
For sure.
And they've gotten placed and people stream them. And I'm like, who's listening? Are you listening to this like on the way to work, getting pumped for your data entry job?
Or like, this is intense. Or like lifting weights.
People go to the gym. I get it. Anyway, I think it's like when you're writing music that you would write anyway and your heart's behind it and your integrity's behind it, like you feel that. I make a joke, but it's like my heart is not behind the jock rock, steroid rock stuff, but luckily, you can kind of fake that. That's pumped up anyway.
Yeah. And I'm curious. So you live in Lansing, Michigan.
Yeah.
Am I remembering correctly? Are you a military kid as well?
I am. Both my parents were in the Army.
Okay. My dad was in the Navy. So when did you end up in Lansing? Did you kind of grow up there?
I mean, so I'm 41. So I guess like I've been here since I was 10. But born in Landstuhl, Germany. So we lived in Germany for maybe like 4 years. And then moved to Arizona. So lived in Sierra Vista, Arizona for a minute. And then, we came to Lansing when I was like 10 going on 11.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Were your parents, did they get out at that point?
At that point, they had split.
Okay.
And then my mom wanted to come back to Michigan. Both of their families are from Michigan, but my mom wanted to be closer to her sisters and they lived in Michigan.
Both my parents grew up in Lansing and East Lansing.
Oh, wow.
They went to East Lansing High School. That's where they met. And then my dad went to the Naval Academy and went in the military. They got married and we moved around my whole life. So I lived in Lansing for 1 year when I was in fourth grade. But then my whole family lives there. My brother went to Michigan State and will never leave. He's like a Michigander through and through. Before we lived in Nashville, we lived in New York City. We've only ever known being musicians in a music industry town. And there's pros and cons to that.
Yeah, in towns that like feel like there's no way to do it outside of that town.
Yeah.
Being New York City and Nashville.
For sure.
In New York City, everybody believes that you can't make music or make a music
anywhere else
outside of New York City.
In Nashville, everyone's like...
And then you move to Nashville, it's like only Nashville.
Yeah.
You know, with all of our love to Nashville and our friends here, there are like, I would say like local celebrities in Nashville that are like, people are like, wow, they're massive. And I'm like, people in Memphis don't know who this person is. And that's 3 hours down the road. I hear you.
Hilarious.
That's awesome. Like, let's pump each other up, but let's keep a broader perspective here.
Yeah. But we do have, obviously, there's tons of musicians who are building a career who do not live in a music industry town. And I'm always so curious, especially now we finally were leaving Nashville. Mm-hmm. We're moving to Lansing for a year while we look for property in Massachusetts. But I'm wondering if you can speak to your experience of the choice to stay where you're from, where your family is, like all the positives and possibly negatives of that. And especially in the sync world and the kind of and the musical style, did it ever come up, should I move to LA or New York or something in your mind and what that's been? Because location is such an interesting, it plays such an interesting role in creatives' lives when working in a commercial sense.
For sure. Be totally honest. Currently, I've been thinking a lot about leaving. I think there is a ceiling of what opportunity can look like. There's also like, I can travel if I want, right? So if I want, I could just like fly out to these spots for a couple months, come back. The work I do outside of music is very flexible. I teach with a nonprofit, but I'm like on staff. So if I'm like, I can't teach, but we have other teachers, I can like make a plan for them if I wanted to. It's weird. Like, I think coming up in like a city that's not a music city, I was in a unique position where around like 2005, 2006, around actually when J Dilla and Proof both died, there was a movement to figure out some way to like fill that gap that the Michigan hip hop scene had lost. And during that time, Lansing actually started a monthly. And for a good like 5 years, if you were playing anywhere near Michigan or in Michigan, like a respiration is what the show was called, was happening, you would hop on that lineup. And so there was mad people who like I would have never really seen, but because we had that thing in our city, it kind of worked. So like Elzai from Slum Village, Liza Garza, who was like part of the Deaf Poetry Jam that happened on HBO. Like, so we're in this unique, weird time where like people were coming here. I remember I saw it might have been right before her signing got announced, but Red Bull had a tour where they hit up college towns, and one of the stops was East Lansing, and it was SZA, and the opener was Lizzo. And like, so it was like a weird, unique time where like I remember Chance the Rapper played in Lansing right before he dropped Acid Rap. It was this unique, weird time where we were like a hub of the scene. So I think that period of time allowed me to build a career in a city like Lansing where like I didn't need to move. After that, if I'm honest, I think I probably got comfortable being like a big fish in a small pond. Like everyone knows me here. Everyone loves what I do. And so I think there probably was like apprehension of like, how do I make it happen somewhere else? And then probably the other time I thought really, really hard about it, it's probably near 2020. And then we all know what happened then. So it's like, I'm not leaving. And then like, there's nowhere to go. We can't go anywhere. But as of late, I have been thinking about it a lot, especially since with working in sync, a lot of the companies I work with aren't here. One of them being Marmoset, that's in Portland. And like, I think long and deep about like, yo, they're always working on new projects. And like, they've called me to jump on stuff, but I'm like, I know proximity is a real thing. And so it's like, you're not going to be thinking of me if you don't see me in the grocery store, or you don't know that I'm in town that we can work in person. So I have been thinking about that a lot lately. What would it feel like to move just because the opportunities I want, they're not here?
I actually do some work with them for Marmoset too, but I got in with them from somebody that lived in Portland for a long time and like knows them, you know, like I just know them as names on an email.
For sure.
You know, do you create with other people or are you pretty self-contained?
I definitely create with other people. There's been a couple people on the Marmoset team. Like last spring, I actually flew out there and worked on a whole album. Me and Hunter Love worked on some stuff. Outside of that, sometimes I do work with producers here and then pitch it to them. But yeah, I produce some of my stuff, but I like writing way more than producing. So if I can work with a producer, and then even if the producer doesn't know sync that well, if I can be like, oh, that's cool, you should change this. Because I at least have enough like understanding to know like, I like that, we need a transition there. Or like, can we add something more melodic there to build it? I sit in that seat more, but I know if I'm producing and writing, I will critique it painstakingly way too much. And then it'll be 8 months working on one song. we don't need that pacing.
It definitely takes a balance, caring about it, putting in the effort, but also non-attachment. Being like, cool. And like you mentioned, like having the specific ear. I always say like, when you're writing with placements in mind, it's a pretty like unique frame to be making music in. Once you kind of understand the kind of unspoken framework that it needs to have and the cuts and the builds and all of that, like you can listen to songs that are released as singles and you're like, they know they were going to place this. That's where this is coming from. I have people here in town, but then also I know some listeners of the show have asked me how I got into sync, which I kind of stumbled into it more or less. I'm wondering if you could share how you got into it.
2017, maybe, I signed with like an indie label called Elect Recordings. That was just one of the main things they focused on. They weren't doing heavy playlisting. They'd get some of that, but they were like, we pitch a lot of stuff for sync. And so I'm always like just very inquisitive. I think growing up, my mom was like, I would always ask why 100 times. So I'm just really like, so how does that work? Oh, okay, cool. So what are they looking for? All right, cool. And so like, I just started like learning a lot. And then when I left the label, I was like, okay, I still want to do this. All right, what were the companies we worked with? Okay, I'm going to email them. Oh, they're not responding? I'm going to keep following up until they answer me. My stuff's already in their catalog. So how can I pitch on my own? And then I'm just very much like, I will read. And so I've probably read and watched every video to learn how to do it on my own. But that label is how I got introduced into it.
Nice. And is it for people who don't know, there's like a couple different ways to be like in sync. There's places like Marmoset, like we had talked about, or Music Bed is a large one, which are like music libraries that either will take your catalog and put it in their library, or they'll pay commissions to have you create stuff. And then there's also sync reps, which might be like at a publishing company or at a label or something that are pitching like directly to music supervisors in movies and shows. Do you cover both directions, or do you focus more on library work? Or
it's been a mix. I think I work more with like agencies like a Marmoset, Cozy and stuff like that. I think I just got some stuff submitted to like APM, and I've done some stuff with Universal Music Group UK, but primarily it's like agencies for the most part.
Yeah, agencies like that, at least in my experience, there's a little bit of money up front rather than everything being on spec and like a we'll see what happens.
Yeah,
I think there's a balance. I think a lot of it has been, which is how the nerd in me helps. I will look at trends I see just in like the music industry in general. I'll always look at like an iSpot.tv and TuneFind and look at what's getting placed. I've done some things where I'll get a demo fee, or the project I did, they commissioned that. But a lot of what I'm doing is I'm trying to predict what I think will work in 6 months. I'm like, all right, I'm gonna make like five of these joints. My batting average has been pretty good. Like, it's, I think you can kind of tell what's gonna work. Kind of how you were saying, like, when you understand those unspoken things, you're like, oh, this record just dropped. They're gonna love this for that. They're not asking for it now. And then, like, in 6 months, they're like, oh, we need some of this. And it's like, cool, I made it three months ago. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's smart. I kind of do the same again on my sphere of music making, which luckily, you know, because I'm not in more of a pop sense, traditional pop, for placements, people are always going to want something that sounds like the Black Keys, you know? So it has some shelf life there, emotional, dramatic songwriter
for sure.
Stuff that somebody could either fall in love or die to.
Those will always happen. Those two specific things are going to happen.
Death and taxes, man.
Multiple times.
They have a little bit more of a shelf life. Is it fulfilling for you creatively at your artist core, or does it feel like you're performing a service role?
Yes. Yes and yes. It is creative to my core. I feel like we are always performing a service, and maybe that's just my perspective, but even like, because a lot of songs I write, I will also perform. Right. And so I think I'm also doing a service if I can brighten someone's day, or if I can impart wisdom or a message that they might need in that time. So that's kind of like how I've approached it. I also used to joke and say I'm the self-proclaimed most encouraging rapper in the world. Right. And so I think like that encouragement I can do on stage is encouragement that works in an ad. And it also, like, sometimes if I'm down, I can listen to my own songs and get that little boost that I need as well.
Yeah. That's great. Sounds like the perfect trifecta.
Yeah.
Hey, just a quick pause from this conversation. The Other 22 Hours is an independent production built entirely on the idea that these quiet, honest conversations matter. The best way to support our work is simply to share it. So if you can think of one person who would appreciate this show, please pass it along. And if you haven't yet, please follow our show on your listening platform of choice or subscribe to our channel on YouTube. It's a small action that makes a massive difference for us. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation.
And also, this changes for each person depending on what phase of life we're in, but kind of self-expression versus intentional messaging. They might overlap or they might be different, but also music being a vehicle of communication, of communicating a specific message, an intention. And your music definitely has that. And some background, you and I met in 2021, I think, on Zoom for Western State Center, which is a nonprofit organization out of Oregon that promotes inclusive democracy. And we were specifically in a cohort that was multimedia artists, so not just musicians, but a cohort of musicians being educated about anti-Semitism. And basically the thesis of Eric Ward, who was the incredible leader of Western State Center at the time, that anti-Semitism is also the root of anti-Black racism.
Yeah.
And essentially, like, educating us, and then how do we as artists use our art and our platforms to communicate and impact social change. I've done a couple different things with Western State Center, even outside of that. And Eric said something one time that has always stuck with me, is that art and music is so powerful because artists can imagine a new future. And that's how we can impact change. And he also said that They have found in their work of studying how artists can impact social change that a lot of times the smaller regional indie artists can have a stronger impact than a massive pop star that has a big platform. That's just to give the listeners some context and background. So I'm curious for you, because I feel like my music has maybe not as overt messaging. Like sometimes when people are shocked that I am super liberal, feminist, anti-racist because of something I post on social media, I'm like, have you listened to my songs? But I guess it's a little more covert sometimes, and I'm not writing protest music, but I'm wondering if you can speak to that a little bit of like, you have positive messaging, but also if you feel any sense of responsibility that some artists do and some artists do not at all. And that can also be informed by our role in these societies that we live in and how we are treated.
So for me, just because I think this will give context of like why my approach of how I do it is, a couple of years actually after high school, a couple of my friends started working for a student group at MSU called EMRL. It's the Multiracial Unity Living Experience. It has a twofold purpose. One is to raise critical consciousness and to build community that centers difference. And so a lot of the work that I learned in those spaces was like about, we have to have these hard conversations, wrestle with these things, not to be attached to our ideas. And like through those conversations and building genuine relationships, we can see actual change. I'll be transformed not only if I hear about someone being done wrong or if I happen to know someone, but like if my life is deeply intertwined with that person, then at that point, I am no longer like, oh yeah, I know someone that went through that, but like what they went through offends me as well because I take part in like it hurting me if it happens to them, right? And so for me, I think a lot of like how I approach writing songs, you may never get a totally in your face political song that's like, we're fighting and taking down the establishment. One, because I don't know if one, you need to hear that from me and if it will be done well or if it'll be done just because I feel like I need to do it. But what you might hear me do is make a song that can bring people who look different together. And then I'd much rather have that conversation. And so that's been like really my approach. Like if someone does something racist at a show, am I going to make a song about it? No, but I might hop off the stage and have a conversation with you. Like I'm very comfortable directly confronting it. I just don't know if it serves the art well for me specifically to do that. Cause I also think about like, how do I make it that everyone still feels safe to have that conversation? And like, not to say like, if you're being a total like belligerent racist, that you should feel that I'm a safe space, because I'm not. But like, I'm not a safe space for you. I think for me, like when I'm doing art, I just don't know if I can communicate that as clean as a conversation and a song. And if it's going to be clunky and cause things to get misconstrued, I'd rather not do that and like have a conversation with you.
Yeah, I relate to that. And I think in today's world, writing songs about love and people of all different walks of life being in joy together, it is political. And, you know, I can't help but think of like Bob Marley. He was a political singer and his songs are all about love, but there's a lot of strength and messaging in that. I always think of the different roles art plays. And in my own space, I'm kind of always contemplating of like, well, what type of conversation should I be having in the song? And what do I have outside of the song, but through the song?
That's good.
What you were saying about using your art and your music to like bring people to the table and create the community, like is something that we've touched on a lot in these conversations, is the role that music can play in community and the fact that you either covertly or overtly get such a wide range of people together in the same room on this commonality. And I think, you know, it's no wonder that when you have people in power that embody hate and exclusivity inevitably target artists first.
Yeah.
It's because art is dangerous.
Yeah.
When you're trying to divide and conquer, art is a dangerous thing to have in a society.
That's so real.
Tying that back into what you were saying, like being open and willing and proactive to then have the conversation once the community is there. I think that is where that gets rare. I see it commonly down here, being in Southern musicians and the culture of the South. There's not a lot of gray area. Either people are like overtly like, this is my stance and fighting, which is great, do that. Or they're like, shut up and sing, shying away from saying something publicly. Mm. You know what I mean? Where it's like there's a fear of losing your audience and a fear of alienating people, which I'm not passing judgment on anybody that does that. Everybody has the right and the ability to be the artist that they want to be.
For sure.
But just noting that, like, being overtly like, let's have that conversation, it can be more articulate, it can be more helpful, is a strong stance.
Yeah, I just think if you have me write the song, I'm going to miss something. And I don't want you filling in gaps.
Yeah.
Oh, he meant this. Oh, no, I didn't. I promise.
Yeah.
I knew it.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a sensitive thing. I've always thought, I'm like, I don't know how to write like a protest song. There's some beautiful protest songs out there. And I feel like I have my like protest songs in a certain way. I have a song called If I Wanted Your Opinion, You Would Know. And that's kind of a protest song, I guess.
Right.
It is a little bit. Yeah.
But
it shouldn't be, but it is.
Yeah. It's a feminist anthem. Not to like totally flip gears, but one of the things we'd like to talk about on this is what it takes to be a healthy human, to be able to create your art, and especially living in a music industry town, always have been, there can always be this kind of like, we want to hide the fact that at different times in life, we might be doing other work besides music, that for some reason, like making your income off of music is a badge of honor, which making your money off of music is increasingly harder and is probably only going to get a lot harder as AI. So I'm curious if you can talk about, you have another job, and how that has helped you with financial security, mind space, distraction, all the things, what that has played in your life.
Yeah. So my other gig is I'm like a lead teacher with a nonprofit called All of the Above Hip Hop Academy. We teach kids about culture of hip hop. And then in my class, they learn how to produce and write songs. And then in the summers, I work at a summer camp in Homestead, Pennsylvania called Trails and Camp. My role has changed. I forgot what they called me now. But I used to be in charge of the creativity center. And now I think I'm going to be like helping lead some other directors. So I won't be like teaching specifically, but sort of training and helping them in that role. I truly believe like if you can teach any skill to like an 8-year-old, you fully understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And so like I feel like teaching has been my cheat code of like even getting proficient at writing and producing, because like 8-year-olds are little impatient humans. And so you can't be like, oh, let me wait till I'm inspired. I need to think of an idea. It's literally like, all right, we're going to make a song. All right, what are we doing next? It's like, okay, we're going to do this. And so I have trained myself not to second guess, because then I'm teaching them to second guess. So if a kid is like, let's make a song. All right, what do you want to make a song about? What are you thinking about? Oh, cool, frogs. All right, let me write that down. Frogs. Okay, what about frogs? What do frogs do? And it's like, why are we making a song about frogs? It's like, because we're just going to keep it moving. I only have 50 minutes with all 12 of you. And so we need to get something recorded really quick. It's helped me in that, being very like intuitive in my approach. And it's just, it kind of keeps me listening to everything. Because I'll very much be like, what are y'all listening to? All right, cool. Now I need to go listen to this obscure rapper that you like, that your streamer plays, because I want to be able to actually tailor my lesson to be close to what you like. So I think that's been helpful. If any hindrance, I think it has been a balance of like conserving my creative energy. Because if I'm working on 5 different songs with kids, it's like, then it's like, when do I write my own stuff? And my brain is like already taxed. And I think it's like there's a creativity in curating and planning out a lesson plan and making it engaging. So I think that's been like the balance of like helping pay my bills, but also like, dang, if I use this energy in here, would I double or 10x the income on that? And so trying to find a healthy balance that makes sense for sure.
Yeah, that's always hard to know, because if you didn't have it, would you have like the inspiration? I teach music and I do songwriting coaching, and I've always done that. And I think maybe in my younger days, there might have been a window of time that I dreamt that someday I would be in a position where I wouldn't have to teach. And something at some point switched over where I really fell in love with teaching, especially teaching songwriting. It became this essential other side of the coin. I started to realize like my own music would feel very different if I wasn't spending time engaging with other writers on this intimate way, helping them and focusing on them, that even if like financially one day I didn't need to have that aspect of my career, I have a hard time imagining not doing it. Yeah, because it feels so, for my personality, I don't want to focus on myself all the time.
Right.
So that service of other people and other people's art really feels vital to having a purpose that's not just my own self-expression and then my own promotion, mm-hmm. which is the part that can be fun, but also exhausting and draining. And it's such a nice balance, especially on like a day-to-day level. Especially I just put a record out, so I'm in promo level and I'm posting all the time about my stuff. And then I can go sit in my office and do some Zoom sessions where I'm just fully focused on somebody else's art and dreams and skills and whatever. And it's not about me. That really helps keep the scale in balance, I think.
That actually reminds me, yesterday, we have a class on Mondays. Most of them are about 9 or 10 years old. And so they're going to work on a song together. And they're like, can we put our song on Spotify? I was like, I mean, if you want. I was like, but your parents have to do it because I can't touch your money. Like, it has to be through that. And then they were like, wait, do you have songs on Spotify? I was like, yeah. And whole can of words. Like, wait. They're looking me up. I'm like, no, relax, relax. I'm just your teacher. Don't do that.
Yeah.
And so it's, yeah, no, but I do like that process of like, definitely with working with youth, like I love, like, they just look at me like, you're the old guy that's cool and thinks I'm cool. And like, just leave it at that. Perfect. You don't need to think anything else. I love that perspective. So nah, that balance is good. I do enjoy it too.
With kids, it's pretty magical. When we lived in New York, we both were teaching artists in different school programs at different times. And there was one school that we taught at the same school. It was like the Brooklyn Philharmonic had an arts program for middle school. He taught a percussion class and I taught a singing.
I taught a rock band class.
Oh, that's fire.
A percussion class. You're laughing because you know.
Yeah.
For those that don't know, when you have extracurricular musical activities, guess what kind of kids they put in the percussion class? It's not the ones that listen really well. I'll just say that. There serving the teachers like a gym class serves the teachers, where I'm letting the kids get rid of their energy.
Yeah, but I taught a piano class and a singing class, and some of those girls from my singing class, and it was a lot of girls, this was 15 years ago at this point, they still reach out to me.
Oh, wow.
And they like, oh, yeah, I have Paula. She like applied to take private lessons with me last year, and I had a phone call with her. She's in her 20s now.
That is so
cool. She was like 12. She was like, I don't know, Miss Michaela, your song, is this what Mama meant? It just really changed my 12-year-old heart. She's yeah, there's three different girls from that like comment on my YouTube. Wow. And we all have those teachers, the different teachers throughout childhood that you're like, oh, that one year, they really made an impact. And when you get to feel that you were that person for someone.
So cool.
Those are the things that really matter. And music programs, art programs, they sometimes are like the way that kids survive those years. So
that's so dope. I used to jokingly say, I'm only halfway joking, but I was like, I'll know I won in life if one day I'm the person that gets the most thank yous at the Grammys because all my students are up there winning.
Yeah.
Like, I'd be a happy old man. It was like, I had James. You had James. That's crazy. And I'd just be like, oh, look at them. They did it.
Yeah.
I'd be like, oh, yeah, no, you can't tell me anything. Look at all my students. Look what they did.
Yeah. I saw somewhere on the internet a beautiful, I don't know anybody's names, but the writer, director of Sinners.
Ryan Coogler.
Yeah. He brought his writing teacher to an awards something and was talking about how she changed his life, that she was like, you should do this. And just one person.
So cool.
Yeah. Giving you that encouragement and believing in you. Just saying like your stories are worth telling, which everyone's are.
Thinking about the 1 7-year-old. In South Williamsburg that I had, because I did a lot of teaching when we were in New York. I came home one day and Michaela's like, man, you look deflated. I'm like, yeah, it was rough, long day. I was like, this class is difficult. It's ridiculous. I had a kid walk up to me, percussion class, middle of school. Like, this was like they took time out of their class to come down to the auditorium where I was teaching percussion and they go back to their class. And I asked them to do something. I was like, hey, let's keep our sticks on the ground. Let's be quiet, whatever, you know, something. I had to do some kind of disciplinary thing. And the kid stands up and walks right up to me and he goes, fuck you, you can't tell me what to do. And I said that to Michaela and she goes, oh my God, what high school are you at? I'm like, he was 7. That was a 7-year-old.
Yeah.
That is wild.
He was so just downtrodden. And I was like, how old are these kids? He's like, second grade.
Second graders.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. All that to say, I've also had many, many fulfilling moments in teaching. When you teach people that want to learn, it is so fulfilling. When you get that spark back, it's like, cool, let's go deep. I'm going to try to not completely flood you with information right now, but like, this is exciting. Let's go.
Yeah. Which when you're teaching, like, especially when you're in sometimes underfunded public schools, you don't have the equipment. I remember that my piano class, I had like 25 kids that were in seventh and eighth grade and five keyboards and a bunch of extension cords. And to figure out like the map of extension cords to set up the keyboards and not be doing it for the entire class and figure out a system where I had worksheets where they were doing, it was insane. But the creativity and like, how do I have musical games that will engage these children?
Exactly.
So they'll stay busy while this kid, and this kid is like a piano prodigy and is playing like classical pieces. And then this kid is like, can't play Mary Had a Little Lamb. It's like,
it's you got to juggle so much.
Yeah. It's good for your brain.
It's a cliche in movies, but like the air quotes bad kid in school that like shows up in the music class or the sports team or whatever. And like, it was kind of difficult at first. And then you as the teacher share something that connects and sparks them. And they're like, oh.
Yeah.
And they go like way deep. And all of a sudden, montage, 6 months later, they're like really in it. And it's such a valuable thing.
Every quote unquote bad kid to me has always been just a hurting kid. A kid that needs.
Or bored.
Yeah.
Or bored, you know, in the very
needs attention.
Typical way that you're taught in a classroom doesn't
work for them.
Yeah.
You know? And so you give them music and this thing. You're like, cool. What are we writing a song about? And they're like, what do you mean? You're supposed to tell me. And you're like, no, you tell me.
Yeah.
What are we doing? And they have that freedom. They're like, whoa, what? I can do whatever I want. And then it sounds like this. Like, that's cool.
Yeah. I definitely had an eighth grade girl who I was fully afraid of. And because also I'm 5'2" and I like just blended in with the kids. I was also like 25 or 26 at the time. And everybody thought I was
one kid
really inappropriate when like a 14-year-old boy was like hitting on me. And I'm like, I'm your teacher. Get out of here. But yeah, I had a girl that I was like fully afraid of. And I was like, remember, you are an adult. You are an adult. You are an adult. And by the end, I was her best friend.
Hilarious.
Just had to force some love onto her in the most appropriate way.
Yeah, for sure.
Anyways, we're nearing the end.
Summary. Arts education is important.
Arts education is very important.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also, like, again, part of the mission of this podcast for us has been bringing conversations to light that we've kind of all kept hidden behind the scenes. And the further we get along in this career path, we're just like, this is such bullshit. The farce that so many of us are putting forth on social media and how unhealthy this is for our skewed senses of reality that are not actual reality. So part of this is all of the different things of what it takes to build a life and kind of the stereotypes that some people might think are inhibiting us are actually the things that are feeding so much creative work. And just always having opportunities for more of those conversations, I think, is part of this. We always finish with our last question that I, for the life of me, can never say. So Aaron always says it.
I love it. It's a choose your own adventure, speaking of giving somebody options. And it is either something that someone has told you along the way or you've read or heard in a talk or something that continues to keep you inspired and fill your cup and it resonates with you. Or conversely, something that you wish you knew when you were first starting to make a career out of your creativity.
I'll say something that I wish I knew. A lot of the norms or rules are just like someone's understanding of how they did it. Like, I think a lot of times I would watch someone and be like, that's how I have to do it. And then it was very limiting on like the approach I could take, or even just looking at like, what is the pathway? And it's like, oh, you have to get signed and then you do this and do that, and just not even realizing like there's different pathways on how you can make music and make money with it, or how you can still use your art to impact other people's lives. I think when I first started, it was very much like there was only one route. I go to New York and get signed to Rockefeller Records and Jay-Z is my boss, you know, like my brain was like, there's only one route and there's only one way to do it. And then I think as it expanded, it still felt like, oh, here's another route. And not thinking that like you can actually blaze your own path and innovate and do your own thing. And I don't think until I got like much older that I really understand like, oh, that's a way, but there's not just one way. And it's not like this is the way, but it's like, okay, y'all did that, but I think this will work too. I wish I would have known that way earlier, because there's a lot of stuff that I'm like, I didn't have to do that. Why was I doing that? I looked silly doing that. I didn't even feel natural when I was doing it. I just thought I had to. And I was like, I don't even like doing this.
Yeah. Oh, man. I wasn't even young when I had those realizations. You know, it's like that happened. We moved to Nashville when just before I turned 30. And those was a good bunch of years where I was like, I wear cowboy boots and pearl snaps. It's like, dude, I grew up in Maine. And it was, I brought all of that to Buffalo Exchange on the same day. And I will say that that's the only time I brought clothes to Buffalo Exchange. They bought everything. But I
love
just,
it.
I'm not a cowboy.
Yeah.
I can't even ride a horse.
I'm not a cowboy.
That is so funny. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I always joke with people, like when I first started making music, like when I was in high school, it's bad. Cause like, I think someone once found a mixtape we did. They're like, hey, I found this. Like, oh, cool. Let me have it. And then I broke it when they left. All I would make music about was like beating people up and taking their girlfriends.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Two things I didn't do. But I like to that point, like I thought, like, oh, this is what we have to talk about. And I'm like, what is it? I don't want to fight anyone. I don't even want to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a writing exercise I do with a lot of my students and at workshops is like free write on like what you think you should write about. Covertly just brush over like what I should write about and see what comes out. And then, okay, now write about what do I want to write about? And then now write about what do I need to write about?
Ooh, that's good.
And all in the free write of set the timer, don't let your pen stop moving, don't censor yourself, don't filter yourself, just go. And it's really interesting because, especially in genres like country music, you're like, oh, I guess I write about like whiskey or beer or what. And then you're like, wait, but this isn't my lifestyle. Or then you start living that lifestyle because you think that's what you're supposed to do. And then you're like, this doesn't feel good. So it's an interesting arc for everybody of being like, what are we emulating? The art of copying to learn. And then how to transform into what's my thing to talk about? How do I want to write and share?
That's so good.
Man, and also what a full circle way to bring this conversation around, because we started talking about sync and writing for placements, which is like writing in a very specific framework.
Right.
So there are like, you kind of got to follow these rules, especially if you're writing for a brief. It's like, it needs to be about this and this and this, but not this and this and this.
Exactly.
You know, so it's like, you got to see the path and be like, cool, I honor your path, but I'm going to do my own thing. What a full circle thing.
That's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, James, thank you so much for taking time with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, have a good one.
We know your time is valuable and we're grateful you chose to spend this hour with us.
If this conversation resonated with you, know that it is just one of many. We have an archive of over 140 conversations, so if you're looking for where to go to next, you can find curated playlists by topic on our YouTube channel or simply scroll back in this feed to find our conversations with Roseanne Cash, New York Times bestselling author Maggie Smith, Lucius, JD McPherson, and many others.
This show is produced by me, Aaron Schaefer-Bates, with help from Michaela Ann. All the music you hear is written, performed, and produced by me as well.
Our show is edited and mixed by Leland Holden at Podpunch, and we are proud members of the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network.
Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.